Beyond. That revolution starts right now. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand, and The Real Issue is a public affairs talk show. We're here every Wednesday night from 6 until 7 p.m. This edition of The Real Issue is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Paradise Community Guild, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guild invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguild.org. You can also find them on Facebook. You can also give them a call, 762-1490. So with the national economy seeming to emerge from the pandemic economy, albeit slowly, it may come as a surprise to hear that the California state budget has gone from tens of billions of dollars in surplus to a predicted revenue of $30 billion less than last year's budget, with an estimated budget gap of $23 billion based on last year's spending. All of this was outlined in Governor Gavin Newsom's budget proposal this week. In his proposal, which will be revised in May after state income taxes have been filed, Newsom lays out how he will address this budget shortfall and how the last few years of budgeting has left the state in the best possible position to address this moment, according to Newsom's budget. So during the first part of The Real Issue, we will talk with an expert on the state budget and how the proposals will impact low and middle income Californians. Then during the second part of The Real Issue, Jim Brobeck of Aqua Alliance will talk about whether or not these latest storms have ended our statewide drought. He will also talk about the reality of building sites reservoir, and finally about the urban forest master plan that will be discussed during an online public forum tomorrow night that you can join. So to begin, to talk about what is included in Governor Newsom's state budget proposal, I have on the phone with me the executive director at the California Budget and Policy Center, Chris Haney. I am always excited to welcome you back to The Real Issue, Chris Haney.
Thanks for having me. I'd love to be here.
So let's jump right in. Governor Newsom just released his preliminary budget yesterday. And so, honestly, I really appreciate you giving us your quick analysis on short notice and, you know, what's in his proposal. But before we, but what we know as predicted, the amount of revenue for this cycle will be much lower than the past few years, and the deficit of $23 billion, less than expected. Chris Haney, before we get into what's included in the budget, remind us how the structure of the state revenue is, what is the structure of the state revenue, and how we have gone from $100 billion surplus last year to an estimated $25 billion deficit in only 1 year.
Yeah, the easiest way to understand that is that we are very reliant as a state on our personal income tax system. We get 70% of state revenues from that personal income tax that we all pay on our wages and salaries and other forms of earnings. And it's progressively structured, and I don't mean that politically. That's tax policy speak for saying that we expect people who earn a lot more to pay a lot more, as a way that we've structured the system to be more fair. And that's been supported by voters for years and years and years in California. But the reality is that people who earn more tend to not earn more from wage and salary income. They tend to make it from things like stock dividends and capital gains. And so what's happening in the economy right now is the stock market has cooled off a lot compared to where we were a year ago. And so the state's revenues are coming in much lower than they were at the same time a year ago, and that's what's driving this move from a big surplus from people making a lot of money off of the stock market to now losing money or not making very much money, and that's where this shortfall or deficit is coming from.
Which in some ways is frustrating, because last year, I think probably you and I spoke last year around this time, or even later towards the summer, and I was asking, why do we have such a giant surplus when the economy is not doing well? And sort of the good news back then was, well, really rich people are becoming really rich, and in California, we tax them. But the bad news is, now that the stock market is not doing as well, and more people are back at work, our state income, our state revenues are also being lowered. Is this, it's like, on the one hand, it's like, oh, that's a great idea to structure our revenue that way, except for moments like now. How do other states do it compared to how California does it? And do you approve?
Yeah, I think that I do approve of the way California does it. The only alternative is to actually tax people who make less more. Mm-hmm. And then that produces less revenue.
Right.
And so you end up less able to support public services. So I think California's model is the right model, but it does create more fluctuation because when economic conditions change, California's revenue picture changes very quickly. So it's something that has to be managed. And
yeah,
the way that you manage it is you put away a lot of that money during the good times in savings accounts or reserve funds. You try to be careful about how you spend it. You pay down debts. You know, you do the kind of things that a household would do when you know you're in good times, but you know around the corner things might get a little rocky. And state leaders have actually done that to a great degree for about the last decade. And so California, relative to other states, is actually very well poised to actually weather the downturn we're facing now, and probably even a larger downturn if that's what's coming, you know, say a few months ahead. Yeah. So we're in pretty good shape, and we can talk more about that in terms of what's in the budget.
Well, actually, that was my next preliminary question before we jump into the budget. I mean, I pulled out of the governor's the summary of the budget, and I'm quoting it, and it says, "Fortunately, through the prudent planning and budget resilience built into previous budgets, the state is in its best fiscal position in recent memory to address this slowdown." So Chris Haney, explain the statement further. And I mean, in other words, how have the last few budgets been different under Newsom's administration compared to prior governors? And more importantly, it sounds like you do agree with the statement that the budget that we are, the state budget is in a good position to overcome this slowdown.
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that it's both Governor Brown and Governor Newsom and the legislatures that they worked with over a period of pretty much a decade since we came out of the Great Recession around 2012 and 2013. And since that time, in large part because of the really dramatic difficulties that the state had back then, practices have really changed. So the state has put away, driven by voters asking them or requiring them to do so, putting significant funding away into state reserves, our state savings accounts. So we have $37 billion sitting in state reserves that the governor isn't even calling upon to be used yet, in terms of this current shortfall. And the state has paid down a whole series of debts in the budget. That means that we've cleared the books on some things that actually freed up a lot of cash and a lot of space that the state can now use if needed.
And you are, I didn't lose you, did I? Oh, we did lose them. I don't know how that happened. All right, we're going to take a very, very, very quick break. Let me get Chris Haney back on the phone. I don't know what happened to him. So you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. Yep. Hold on one second. Let me get him. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. All right, we are back, and I have Chris Haney from the California Budget and Policy Center back on the phone. Chris Haney, we were talking about the structure of, you know, I was asking you about how do these latest changes in California budgeting changed, and you were talking about the rainy day fund, and then we got cut off. So if you don't mind continuing from there.
Yeah, great to be back. Sorry about that. So we have $37 billion in state savings accounts, or what we call reserves or rainy day funds, and the governor isn't even calling for those to be used in filling the shortfall that he's just outlined yesterday. So we still have those available. State leaders also spent time over the last decade paying down some significant debts, which frees up a lot of space when you go into some kind of a downturn in the future. And then a lot of the spending that state leaders committed in the last year or two, when there were these really large surpluses, like you mentioned at the beginning, a lot of that was put into one-time commitments on things like infrastructure and facilities, or saying that we'll commit to spending something, say, a few years out. And that's allowing the governor to say, well, look, we can slow some of that down or pull some of that back for a year or two in order to help cover a shortfall. So a lot of these maneuvers that they used in recent years are actually going to allow them to manage through a potential down period pretty well and way better than we did during the last recession.
Right, right. And, and in the conversations that we've had, you and I and other folks from your organization have had over the years, I remember very clearly talking about, yes, the reason that they're going to spend this now and not commit to long-term spending is because at some point we are going to have a slowdown in the state economy. So seems like smart, like we have finally shifted in the state to more smart budgeting. So Chris Haney, let's jump into what the budget actually says. Give us an overview of the governor's proposed budget. What are the priorities in light of this predicted slowdown?
Yeah, I think the first big one I would highlight is that the governor is trying to protect a lot of the expansions that he and the legislature agreed to in recent years that were focused on improving various sorts of assistance for low and middle income Californians. And so this includes expanding access to health care, expanding educational opportunities, providing additional cash assistance to low income and very low income households, some big investments in housing and homelessness. And so those were really big priorities in the years when we had more revenue available. And he's basically saying, look, we're going to protect as many of those investments as possible. And then the second priority is then, okay, how do you cover the shortfall? And basically what they're doing is they're pulling back a series of multi-year investments on infrastructure, one-time spending in certain program areas that they can roll out a little slower and sort of, you know, decide that, okay, a couple of years from now, the economy should be better off and we can build that back up. And so they're basically just kind of slowing down some plans that they put in place. There are a few places where they're making some cuts. There are some, there are some places they've made massive investments in climate change, for instance.
Yeah.
And they are pulling back some of that, mainly because they think they can slow it down. So there are some cuts. I don't want to say that there aren't some, but and they are putting another piece in that they call trigger cuts, which basically means that some programs will see some cuts, say, later in the year or by this time next year if conditions don't improve. So they're saying, look, we hope things improve, and then we'll be able to fund this, and if we can't, we'll have to pull back a bit.
Right. And as I was reading through it, as I was looking through it, I certainly don't have the brain capacity to go as deep as you do, of course. But as I was just kind of reading through it, what came to mind every once in a while was, oh, yeah, they're just kicking the can down the road, the, you know, age-old strategy of politicians. But that's not really true. I mean, it does seem very strategic of, we're just going to delay some of these because just as we knew the economy was going to slow down, at some point it's going to start to rise again, and we're going to see state revenues start to rise once again. So it does seem, as you mentioned earlier, California has sort of a volatile revenue source because it's so highly based on, for example, Wall Street. And so it does seem like sound budgeting. Am I reading any of this correctly?
I think it's mostly true that, you know, there are some places, as there would be in any budget with a state of this size, there are some places where we at my organization think the governor could not spend some money and spend it more wisely. But on balance, you know, the vast majority of what they're proposing is fairly wise. I mean, if you think about something like pulling back on infrastructure, I think we all know the state needs to invest more in infrastructure. We're constantly dealing with the need for better roads and improving water infrastructure and climate change related infrastructure. And so it's not like we don't need that, right? So I don't want people to mishear me, but investments in infrastructure are things that you spend over 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, yep.
And it's like repairing your roof on your home, right? If you think your house is about to catch fire because you know things are about to not be so good, you might slow down or like put that investment in like the next 10 or 20 years off a little bit. That's the decision they're basically saying they're trying to make. They're like, look, we don't think we're going to have all of the money we thought we'd have available a year ago or 2 years ago.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. Chris Haney, I'm talking, if you're just joining us, I have Chris Haney on the phone with me. He's the executive director at the California Budget Policy Center. If you're a regular listener of this program, you hear from Chris Haney and folks from his organization at least once a year, often twice a year, when there's interesting budget stuff happening. So this is always a good one. I always enjoy talking with you folks. So let me ask you this. We've been talking about cuts, and I'm just wondering, are there any opportunities from your perspective, are there opportunities based on our tax structure to actually raise money? Are there obvious loopholes that we could address to actually increase revenue?
Yes, and I think that's probably one of the shortcomings of the governor's budget, is that that's not really been addressed so far. Now, I think if conditions worsen over the next 5 or 6 months, which I think is potentially more likely than the alternative, I think they will have to look into those sorts of options. And the low-hanging fruit here is not about raising tax rates on people. It's actually about taking away tax breaks mm-hmm. for corporations and wealthy individuals that are on the books already and that we spend a lot of money on, many of which don't actually produce the kinds of policy outcomes we're hoping. So these are like, you know, kind of credits, deductions, various sorts of tax breaks for corporations that allow them to not pay as much in taxes as they would otherwise. There's some similar things for very high wealth households. And so if we revisited some of those breaks and said, hey, are those really doing anything good for the California economy? Most of the research for years has said they don't. State could scale them back, take them off the books, and really produce significant revenue.
So, Chris Haney, here's my last, so I'm going to put two questions right into one question, but this is my last one for you, I promise. So just sort of bring us, I want to kind of ask you to go through the timeline. This is just the governor's first budget, and between now and May, which he will issue a May revise, and it's based on tax revenue. You know, like we're going to have income taxes filed, and the state will have a better sense of how much money is really coming in. And two things that you referred to early on in this conversation. One is, while it's in the budget, is one of those things is that a recession is not being considered in this current budget. I mean, the summary clearly says this budget is based on not going into a recession this year. And the other thing is it doesn't dip into the rainy day fund. So talk us through from now until May when the governor submits his revised budget, and then the legislature actually passes a budget, and then bring in the idea of what if we go into a recession and how would that rainy day fund be handled? What is that process? What will you be watching out for?
Yes, you've hit on exactly the right issue. So a lot is unknown right now. It's hard to project revenues for a budget that will start 6 months from now and then runs all the way to a year and a half from now. It's really hard to do that correctly, no matter how smart and good your staff are. So the big part that really helps is that we get about 2/3 of the state's income tax collections come in April, because that's of the April 15th tax deadline, which allows state leaders during that May revision to have a much better picture of what's actually happening with the state's revenues. And so we will know a lot more, or closer to accurate anyway, about what the actual budget picture looks like. If that condition worsens to being like a recession or near recession or something like that, and the state's budget shortfall increases in significant ways, I think you will definitely see the governor and the legislature use some of the reserves that are available. I think you'll see them pull back on more of the one-time funding they committed to mm-hmm. in earlier years. And I think you'll start to see them talk about cutting some funding. in some areas, you know, depending on the size of the potential shortfall. There's also an alternative scenario, which is that the economy bounces back for whatever reasons and the shortfall declines, and they have other options on the table. So I think the key thing to understand is that there's just a lot that's still unknown when you're in January, and we'll know a lot more in May.
Right, right, right. And of course, you will hear from me again in May, and I hope that you accept the invitation one more time as we talk about, you know, the current economic reality at that time and how you think that budget is progressing, especially in terms of your target, your constituency, so to speak, and that is low and middle income Californians. And so, Chris yep. Haney, Executive Director of the California Budget Policy Center, it is always a pleasure to talk with you, and I do hope to talk with you again soon. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you, Sue. Everyone have a good evening.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a really quick break, but do not go back, because I will have Jim Brobeck on the phone with me talking about how this latest series of storms is it actually addressing our drought? What is the reality of the Sites Reservoir and how that all wraps into the Urban Forest Master Plan? Don't go away. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR. We are back. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. We are based right here in Chico, California. My name is Sue Hildebrand. We turn now to the weather here in Northern California and the succession of storms that are bringing in lots and lots of needed rain in our region, which has been in drought on and off really for the last two decades. It is hard not to assume that these storms, which have dumped, get this, 138% of average precipitation for this time of year, it's hard to assume that it has not ended our current drought. The rivers are swelling, even the streets are flooding in areas throughout the state. And the precipitation includes snow on the eastern side of the Sierras, which is our natural storage for the state. As the snow melts, it fills our streams and the reservoirs throughout the summer months. So it looks pretty good. Looks pretty good. But with the continued rain, it's hard to avoid the calls everywhere you turn to build Sites Reservoir over on the far western side of the Central Valley. As the argument goes, if the reservoir had been built already, these storms could capture the excess precipitation for our drier months in years. Now, to talk about the relationship of these storms and the drought, and to talk about the reality of building Sites Reservoir, I have on the phone with me Jim Brobeck. He's the water policy analyst with the preeminent water advocacy organization in the North State and beyond, Aqua Alliance. As always, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Real Issue, Jim Brobeck.
So happy to be here, Sue.
So, Jim, as I walked out the door, I put my raincoat on and I sloshed through all the puddles, and I have people all over the country asking if we're, you know, keeping dry and all of that. So it's hard to not think about, is this the end of the drought? Jim, Talk about the series of storms and the amount of water they have brought as compared to, and I'm using a little air quote here, compared to normal amounts of rainfall and the normal timing of the rainfall in the North State.
Sue, these rainstorms are definitely adding a good amount of water to the giant reservoirs of Northern California. We see the reservoir levels in Shasta Reservoir and Orville Reservoir rising. We're also getting some much-needed flushing of the Delta and the San Francisco Bay, which have been languishing for years with drought-like conditions. And in fact, most years they're in drought-like conditions because so much of the water is pulled out of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and headed south. And this has had some really severe impacts with the accumulation of pollutants, with the algae growth, with the salinity levels in the Delta moving closer and closer to fish habitat. So this is very welcome to the ecosystem down there. However, California is going to need a lot more water to reverse the drought conditions as the state has to catch up with a little rainfall that it has seen over the last few years. The state will need consistent amounts of precipitation for many years to fully recover from the drought. And because of global warming, the atmosphere evaporates water that has fallen at a much faster rate. Therefore, the state needs more precipitation than it consumes to stay balanced. And in a warming climate, the droughts are exacerbated by this evaporative demand.
Mm-hmm.
Sacramento Valley aquifers are significantly depleted and difficult to artificially recharge or to naturally recharge in a short period of time. It takes years for this fossil water to recover. Most of the big pumps that are going in are very deep right now, and they're down in water that's been there for a long time. It takes a long time to recover that. Even if these atmospheric rivers continue into February, it'll take years of rain on the foothill and mountain landscapes to replenish the deep Tuscan aquifer that has been targeted by thousands of the large diameter agricultural wells. And if the current snowpack melts like it did last year early, the demand for reservoir water will outpace supply. And with all the easy-to-dam rivers developed as reservoirs, Sites Reservoir does not promise to be a significant improvement on California drought preparedness. On average, Sites Reservoir would yield about 250,000 acre-feet of water per year for the agencies participating in the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. While these two projects, the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project, pump about 3 to 6 million acre-feet of water per year. So this extra 250,000 of acre-feet is not going to really significantly contribute to the demand, mostly the agricultural demand in the Great Central Valley on the aquifer system and on the surface water supplies. And besides that, sites would drown over 15,000 acres of grassland, woodland, chaparral, riparian habitat, vernal pools, and wetlands. The region where sites would be built is an area that naturally produces selenium and heavy metals. Right now, they're relatively locked up in the soil because there's good roots over there. But if you flood these 15,000 acres, it denudes it of the roots. We've seen what it looks like when Shasta and Oroville get drained. You just have bare dirt that erodes rapidly. And already the streams that flow through Sites Reservoir have elevated levels of heavy metals during rainstorms. This would certainly be exacerbated if they denuded those hills and tried to fill it and drain it and fill it again. According to Jerry Bowles, who is the retired chief of water quality for the Northern District of DWR, he worked for the Department of Water Resources up here. He was the water quality expert. And he said the reservoir will have concentrations of numerous metals, aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, copper, iron, lead, manganese, mercury, nickel, selenium, silver, and zinc. The Coast Range is famous for having these minerals in it. The site's environmental impact report states that evapocon concentration would increase the concentrations of these heavy metals that are dissolved in the water by up to 48%. So the quality of the water provided by site's reservoir would probably not be suitable for any purposes for wildlife habitat and refuges, for instance, or for municipalities, which would have to do extra treatment to clean up the water. The project environmental report admits that the reservoir would produce methylmercury, and they would not stock it with fish due to the bioaccumulation of mercury that would occur. And this is something that happens in most California reservoirs. In Oroville, for instance, they assume that maybe 10 years they would reduce the amount of mercury that's in the water. But there's still problems with mercury in Oroville after over 50 years of operation. And in sites, they know there's going to be mercury in there. So the report explains they're not even going to bother stocking it for the first 10 years and then see if the mercury levels go down.
So let me just jump in and say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Jim Brobeck, water policy analyst for Aqua Alliance. Jim, just let me jump in and say for listeners that, I mean, we've talked about Sites Reservoir quite a bit on this program over the many, many, many years that you have been educating me on water in the North State. But for folks that aren't clear on it, I just want to let you know that Sites Reservoir is a proposed reservoir, and it would be located about 10 miles west of Maxwell, California, which is, you know, Glenn County, Colusa County. So it's southwest of where we are, and it's on the far side. It's in the foothills of the Central Valley. Jim Brobeck, one of the things that I want to ask you about, I know that what you're talking about is the minerals in the soils in that area that would become Sites Reservoir would make that water unusable. I mean, it would be toxic. But let me ask you a different aspect of Sites Reservoir and its inability to be a good solution for our continuing drought situation. On the website that exists to promote Sites Reservoir, it states, and I'm quoting from that website, Sites Reservoir would capture and store stormwater flows from the Sacramento River after all other water rights and regulatory requirements are met for release in dry and critical years for environmental use and for California communities, farms, and businesses when it is so desperately needed. It goes on to say that when operated in coordination with a Northern California reservoir such as Shasta, Oroville, and Folsom, which function as the backbone to both the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project, Sites Reservoir will greatly increase flexibility, reliability, and resilience of statewide water supplies in drier periods. End quote. This sounds like a great idea to address our drought-prone region. But Jim Brobeck, aside from the environmental concerns that clearly have been identified by both Aqua Alliance as well as Jim Boyles from former staffer at the Department of Water Resources, talk about where I don't think it's completely accurate to say that after all of the water rights and regulatory requirements are met, how would they go about doing that? And still, as you mentioned, these current storms are flushing out the delta and actually pushing the salinity back down to the south and back out of the bay. Talk about that aspect of Sites Reservoir, if you would.
Existing water rights on the Sacramento River are five times greater than what is normally available. A lot of the contract water rights are junior water rights, and it's only available when there's surplus water. And so sites, the sites proponents right now are petitioning the State State Water Board for water rights, trying to see if there are more water rights available to divert water. And so they've not been able to line up their own water rights yet. And with the amount of water rights that already exist that are often, more often than not, unfulfilled, I think that would be a problem. And the public relations paragraph that you spoke is something that I've been reading for 10 or 20 years now and has been the argument for building sites reservoir
right.
for at least 50 years. Back in 1970, I think, is when, in the 70s, is when they started looking at it and trying to figure if it would be economically and environmentally feasible to build it. The proponents estimate that Sites Reservoir will cost about $4 billion to construct. This is figures from a few years ago.
Right.
And that already is a 30% increase from some of the prior estimates. So the water from Sites is likely to cost more than $900 to $1,400 per acre foot, which is more than agriculturalists want to pay.
Mm.
They might be able to get the taxpayer to pick it up to do so-called environmental benefits. But as we've discussed before, some of the water quality issues
right.
make that seem to be infeasible. I mean, we don't want another Kesterson Wildlife Refuge situation on our hand where runoff from agricultural fields in the southern portion of the Great Central Valley were funneled into the Kesterson Wildlife Refuge and the selenium in it made it impossible for the birds to procreate. It damaged the embryos. And we could have something similar to that. Also, the Metropolitan Water District's former general manager, Jeff Neitlinger, said that unless the Delta Tunnel project was guaranteed to happen, he would not recommend it moving forward with Sites. The tunnel project has been despised by the public and was voted down in 1982 when it was a surface thing, the peripheral canal. And 40 years later, this tunnel has still not been built. It faces great challenges in construction and great opposition by people in Northern California and by people that live in the Delta. And several experts say that Sites makes no sense unless you can increase the pumping capacity in the Delta by building the tunnel. So the tunnel and Sites Reservoir are sibling projects.
Mm.
Both of them extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them environmentally destructive. And both of them do nothing more than increasing the expectations of a reliable water supply. Rather than focusing on what's really needed here in California, which is conservation.
Right,
we need
right.
to figure how to conserve water. Flexibility has to be done by having flexible crops. So many of the million acres or so of nut trees that have been planted in the San Joaquin Valley, where they don't have a local source of water, where they rely on water imported, and then they tap their groundwater until the groundwater is either gone or it continues to create the big problems down there with subsidence. And flexibility by planting annual crops so they use it when the water's available and not continue to destroy their aquifer system down there.
Right.
So the price of the per acre is too much for farmers to use. And there's so many other aspects of it that make the project unfeasible. And I never like to talk about Sites without talking about the tunnel because they go hand in hand, according to the water manager experts that end up at the far end of the supply line.
Right. And Jim Brobeck, in some ways, I mean, last week and you know, several times over the last 6 months or so, we've talked about the development that was just passed by the city council, the Chico City Council last week, I think it was, Valley's Edge. And so many people have said, you know, the Valley's Edge project is sort of the mentality. The development is the mentality of the 1950s development, where you have, you know, your white picket fence, and you have your big lots, and it's very low density. In some pretty fundamental ways, it seems like, you know, Sites Reservoir is such an like a sort of an old school strategy of water management, where what you have said over, as long as I've known you, is the way that you deal with very little water is you conserve it. You can't make water, so you have to conserve water. And the Sites Reservoir just seems like backwards thinking in terms of not facing reality, not walking into the future. And in that context of climate change, it seems like it's delusional strategy. So,
The proponents of Sites are using climate change as an excuse,
right,
saying
exactly.
Runoff is going to occur earlier and we're going to be losing snowpack. So we need to figure a way to capture the flood flows.
Yeah, which is just silliness.
It makes some sense, but the capacity of Sites Reservoir is insignificant,
right,
compared to the giant reservoirs.
Right.
And the capacity of the pumps that they would need to both pull water out of the river and then pump up over the hill into this off-stream storage, the capacity isn't there. It would take about 6 months of steady pumping out of the river to fill Sites Reservoir.
Hmm.
Some people think Sites will never be filled, even though they shrunk it from 1.8 million down to either 1.3 or 1.5 million acre feet. I don't see how they could ever fill it. And even if they did take 1.5 million acre feet of water out of the river, the thing would only produce about 250,000 acre feet per year. So nothing in it pencils out by my analysis.
Right.
Of course, I'm not a highly paid consultant that gets to work on this thing for year after year after year.
Right.
Or one of the members of the Joint Power Authority that also has a very generous benefit package. But
right, right. Or a politician.
I would like to talk about Valley Edge, though.
Okay. Let me jump in and say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have water policy analyst Jim Brobeck, who is with Aqua Alliance. Jim, if you would, I had somebody write to me and say, oh, you have Jim Brobeck on the air tonight. Ask him about Valley's Edge. Go for it.
Well, people that have the capital to develop big projects like to have big undeveloped land. It's like a blank canvas that they can get in without the constraints of having to deal with existing infrastructure and neighbors and that sort of thing. So large developers love to have open spaces to develop, and that's really the impetus behind this. And several of my friends have been engaged with reviewing the environmental document and coming up with some very cogent arguments against it. But one of the things that concerns me is that the amount of water that they want to use up there for landscaping, especially about 80% of the water California urban use, domestic use, is to do landscaping. And they promise to do some drought-resistant landscaping, but they also plan to plant non-native trees up there. And most alarming to me, based on information provided by the project proponent, they plan to include two so-called water features. These are artificial ponds that will rely on groundwater to fill and to maintain. They claim that the majority of the water used to fill these, they call them lakes, will recharge groundwater supply. But keep in mind that the California Water Service pumps that they will be using suck out fossil water from the deep aquifer, which is a pressurized portion of the Tuscan aquifer system that's recharged from higher in the watershed, not down low in the watershed, but high in the watershed. That's where the deep aquifer is recharged. So these leaky recreational water element ponds would not re-enter the lower Tuscan aquifer. Another thing that really struck me, the name of them, the Frontier, they call it Frontier Lake, will be one of the water elements, and then another water element will be in Pioneer Park.
Oh, God.
6 acres of landscape ponds. I note the conspicuously pro-colonial titles of
these
ponds.
Exactly.
That would be built on occupied Machupta land. and it's just outrageous to me that... that in this era where people are starting to really trying to reconcile the history of this area, the extirpation of the native people from most of their land, that they would be holding up, that they would be labeling these things after the actual colonial mindset. That so disabused the people that lived here. So other people have a lot more details on the other environmental impacts, but the water impact alone, especially with these landscape ponds that they want to fill up with groundwater, I just find it outrageous.
Yeah,
as we're struggling to figure a way to balance our aquifer system.
Right. Exactly. And Jim Brobeck, this is the perfect moment, and especially in our last few minutes together here, but this is the perfect time, as we've been talking about, you know, this is not the end of the drought, because we are drought prone. We're a drought prone area, and we have climate change. And so much of our groundwater is being sucked out for various reasons. We didn't even talk about and we don't have time to talk about the long-term strategy from the Department of Water Resources to exercise or empty the Tuscan water, the Tuscan aquifer, so that they could refill it and own the aquifer. We don't even have time to touch on that. But having said that, I want to turn to the Urban Forest Summit that's scheduled to take place tomorrow night. It's online tomorrow night, Thursday night, starting at 6:00, and it runs till 7:30. Jim Brobeck, at that meeting, the draft urban forest plan will be discussed, and the fact that Chico is considered the city of trees. Jim, talk about the importance of the urban forest master plan and what's going to be discussed at that meeting. And we can't talk about it without having this prior conversation about water and drought and the groundwater and building these ridiculous reservoirs and so on.
Right, and included in the discussion, of course, is the Sustainable Groundwater Management
Act
of 2015, I think it is.
Yep.
Where Chico is part of the Vina sub-basin and is subject to the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Plan. During the previous forum, the Chico Urban Forest Manager, Richie Bamlett, explained that city trees didn't require irrigation because the roots could tap groundwater. However, the plan that has been put together by the master plan for the city of Chico trees, put together by DUDEC. This is a planning and engineering firm headquartered in Encinitas, California. I looked through the environmental plan. There is not a single mention of groundwater, of aquifer, of how the trees, existing trees, and the trees for future generations are going to stay alive if the groundwater drops below the range of their roots.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Chico Urban Forest Manager agrees that groundwater is what keeps these trees alive. Once they're established, they get the roots down into the capillary fringe of the aquifer system. The Vina Groundwater Sustainability Plan, which covers Chico and the surrounding area, has an unacceptable aquifer operational range that may serve well for groundwater banking, but it will dive deeper than historic low levels, and at its deepest will exceed the rooting depth of the Chico urban forest. Mm. Even the deepest rooted valley oak trees. So this is one of the main reasons why Aqua Alliance is pursuing a legal challenge to the Vina Sustainable Groundwater Plan, because it fails to protect the urban forest as well as domestic wells.
Right.
So I'm going to participate in this urban forest tomorrow, because I think it would be helpful for the Chico Urban Forest Summit to recognize that the Chico Urban Forest is a groundwater-dependent ecosystem as defined by SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and it must be considered as we move forward in establishing sustainable management objectives that will keep groundwater levels sufficient to keep our tree canopy verdant during the hot summer months.
Jim Brobeck, in the last, boy, in the last 30 seconds I have with you, how can, I assume that listeners right now can join and either listen in and or participate in the meeting tomorrow. How can people find out about that meeting?
There was an article a couple days ago on Channel 7 News. I saw it online, and I found on that to register to participate in this. Tomorrow you can go do a search on chicotree.org. This will take you to the Chico Street Tree website. And scroll down to the, I think it was the second item, that gives the forum announcement and all the instructions for how to register for the forum, how to get the link so you can participate online, because it's not going to be held in person, since we still are in a pretty high level of COVID transmission. So fortunately, we will be allowed to participate in the comfort of our own homes with our computers. So go to chicotree.org, do a search on that, and that'll give you a link to the Chico Street Tree website, and you'll find the forum announcement there.
Jim Brobeck, water policy analyst with Aqua Alliance. As always, I did not have enough time with you, but as always, I appreciate all the time you can give me.
Sue, thanks for letting me unload
you get
all this information on you and your listeners.
Anytime. I have very smart listeners, and so we appreciate it. Thanks so much, Jim Brobeck. You have a good night. All right, that brings us to the end of this edition of The Real Issue, which is made possible by the generous contributions of KCFR supporters and by Knockout Collision Repair, Chico's high-tech auto body shop specializing in complete collision repair and restoration. Knockout Collision works on all makes and models and always provides complimentary consultations. Appointment or information you can get at 899-9202. You can also find them at knockoutcollisionrepair.com. Chico's fast and fair collision repair. All right, we're going to go out with a song that was suggested to me by a new friend down in New Orleans. This song goes back to, it's by Randy Newman, and it's called Louisiana 1927. And you may remember in 2005 with Hurricane Katrina, the levees failed and like 80% of New Orleans flooded. And I was there. I learned about the 1927 flood, which was even more widespread, even more destructive than what happened in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. So we're going to go out with that. I hope you stay dry. I hope it doesn't flood too bad where you are. And I hope that you don't curse the rain, because we definitely need it. I'll be back next week, same time, same station. And until then, peace out.
What has happened down here is the wind has changed. Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rain real hard and rain for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. river rolls all day, the river rolls all night. Some people got lost in the flood, some people got away all right. River has busted through, clear down to Clackamas. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.